This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for my podcast, Great New American Essays. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's spotlight is on the literary magazine, Oxford American. I'm joined by the magazine's editor, Danielle Amir Jackson. Danielle is a Memphis-born writer and critic and the editor-in-chief of the Oxford American. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Vulture, Book Forum, Lapham's Quarterly, The Criterion Collection, and elsewhere. Honey Grill, Sex, Freedom, and Women of the Blues, her first book, is forthcoming from Farrow, Straus, and Giroux. Welcome to the show, Danielle.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us a bit about the magazine, its history, what makes it distinct, and I'll probably have a follow-up question or two.
Sure. So the Oxford American is a quarterly literary and general interest magazine blend that has been in existence since 1992, founded in Oxford, Mississippi, a very literary town known as the hometown of William Faulkner, and also at that time in the 90s, Square Books was where John Grisham held court. Anyway, over several years and iterations, the magazine moved its headquarters to Central Arkansas, where we are now based at the University of Central Arkansas, also a very proud sponsor. We are dedicated, our mission says we are about illuminating the complexity and vitality of the American South. So we're a place-based magazine, but also we take a really expansive approach to place or space. So writers can be from the region or based in the region or expats to the region or have some kind of cultural relationship to the region. And it can also be about diasporas, right, that are all over the world and also contained within our borders. We like to focus on like the cultural wealth of the region. So every year, probably what readers are most familiar with as far as the Oxford American is our annual music issue. For many years, we would dive deep into the musical heritage and traditions and current music scenes of a particular state. Before that, it was just like a wonderful grab bag of just Southern music in all its bounty. Sure. And those were produced with double albums. Lately, we've been doing like themes on riffs on genre and other kind of like musical forms. Last year, our music issue was based on ballads, and that had Roberta Flack on the cover.
I remember very fondly going to a Roberta Flack concert back in about 1977.
Tremendous
voice, really moving stuff. Great stuff.
Very, very much tremendous voice. Where was the concert?
I was in Minneapolis. I'm from there, and then I had a funny experience. I'm coming down, speaking of place and space. Right. So I came down to teach at what's now Missouri State in Springfield, And someone asked why I'm there. And I said, well, for one thing, I've never lived in the South, so I'm very curious. And one of my new colleagues in the English department said, this is not the South. This same person about 2 minutes later called me a Yankee.
So
I'm like, oh, okay, let's see how this is going to work.
Right. I'm very interested in thinking about Missouri as a Southern state or like a border state, or even just like as a liminal kind of space in between, like an in-between space, right? Where it's not really Southern, not really, a little bit Midwest, a little bit like Yankee. Like, that's very interesting to me. And I'd love to do a Missouri music issue one day.
Oh, I think it's a fascinating border state because by the time you get to Joplin, it feels like you're in the Great Plains.
Yeah.
In Springfield, you're now from the Arkansas border. It
right.
felt very Southern to me. St. Louis has got Southern and Midwestern, Kansas City
absolutely.
Likewise.
Absolutely.
The northern part is, you know, kind of more Iowa with slightly less quality farmland.
Right.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Strange, interesting place.
It's so strange and interesting. My mom lives in a suburb of St. Louis right now, so I'm visiting pretty frequently. And just also selfishly, there's great music.
The Jazz Hall of Fame is in
right.
the city, as well as the Black Baseball Hall of Fame. So
right. And we could just like, I don't know, we could do an entire issue dedicated to like bebop or Charlie Parker or something. So I'd be really excited about
absolutely.
That.
So I was a little bit interested in the magazine's format because Point South, Omnivore, and Features. Features seems fairly obvious. Point South seems fairly obvious. Omnivore, how would you define that in context of the other two?
Yeah, so Omnivore, I would say, is about just like literally it's about like being a voracious consumer of culture in its many forms. So that's usually the section dedicated to some form of culture and arts writing that has like a critical element. So that's why the story about Reba McEntire's rendition of Fancy is in Omnivore. Like there's a lot of critical analysis about that song in addition to like scenes and you know, all of that, but it's always narrative. The magazine focuses on narrative storytelling. But in that section, you get a little bit more like digging deep into criticism.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's an interesting magazine, both because of its sense of place. And I love the Irish poet Seamus Heaney said it, a sense of place issues in a point of view.
Yes.
So I always really like things that have an orientation that way. The other thing is that it's got essay, reportage, portraits. I mean, it goes a lot of places and it doesn't bother me, at least in the least, that it's doing so.
Yes, I hope that that's enjoyable. So, I mean, it's very deliberate. And I feel like from the time the magazine began, there was an interest on the part of the editors to be like firing on multiple cylinders, to be like telling a story different kinds of ways in many different modes and textures. And I've definitely tried to keep to that. So, you know, even just like the way things look or feel on the page, like I want to have shorter pieces. And a lot of the poems do a lot of work to that allow us to just have some breathing space and also allow the reader to enjoy like artwork a lot. You want your long form pieces that are from many different voices and that are reported and deeply investigative and hopefully, you know, help to solve societal problems. You know, that's the goal, that the ultimate hope of and promise of like investigative reporting.
And the magazine's nicely laid out. I mean, it's a very attractive read, I must say.
Thank you. We work really hard on that, like licensing every single image that you see, like individually and reaching out to art galleries. And
it shows, and in a good way.
Thank you.
So let's go to, you sent me several recent issues, and I picked out some pieces that I wanted to discuss. One is What If It All Burned Down by Katrina Andry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really interesting. In part, it's very relevant. My wife was born in Memphis. And we're going to be taking a trip back there because she hasn't been there in a long time, and some other points. But it brought up the question of, does one engage in doing the tourist trade and going to certain sites? I'm thinking about River Road, north of, you know, Louisiana, north of New Orleans. Does one almost get involved, unwillingly or not, in the soft mythologies or the hard mythologies of the Confederacy? And so that was one point of departure for me in the piece. Yeah. How about for yourself?
Yeah, I liked that piece just really asks a lot of questions. It's really a piece about questions, and it's about a woman asking a lot of questions and reckoning on the page with just some very real facts of her family's heritage and just her ancestry, right? Like, she has family connection to this particular plantation property that was an important, the locus point where this, you know, the biggest potential rebellion of the enslaved in the American South occurred and began. And she just asking questions about it. What does that mean for me? What does that mean for how we've been telling stories about what happened, like our past? What could have been different? Like, or what is different because the rebellion was put down? And I just think it invites the intent for me in publishing this was to invite the reader to ask these questions along with her and to reflect on their own relationship to this history and to do with it what you may, right? Like, so I don't know of completely never seeing these places, no matter how like they're laid out, is the answer. That's not personally the answer for me, but I can understand how it might be. You know, I think there are also places that focus in on like telling the story of what happened on their premises from the perspective or with the consideration of the people who were enslaved and labored and died there. So I think it's worth it to intentionally seek out places with that kind of perspective. I know the Whitney Plantation in Louisiana is one. And I went to one recently in coastal North Carolina, historic Stagville, which was the largest plantation in North Carolina. At one point, some 900 people were enslaved there. And they're very intentional about, you know, here is the foundation of an enslaved family's home, and here are the names of people lived in this place. So there are places you can specifically go and reflect from that perspective. I mean, and you could also spend time thinking about places that aren't telling the story with enslaved people at the center.
Yeah. Well, for instance, I had read a piece in Smithsonian talking about it was very disturbing because taxpayer dollars are going to this, and they were across the South, and they were not recasting the story in a more progressive light, to say the least.
Yeah.
And that was disturbing. One of the things I liked about the essay also is it brought in a piece of history that I think a lot of Americans wouldn't know the significance of, which was the Haitian Revolution, which was successful and really drove a lot of terror into the hearts and minds of Southern slave owners. And so the ferocity with which they put down this rebellion that you're alluding to is in no small part driven by that. And I think most Americans, because it's offshore, would not make the connection, but it's real.
Right. I also just like the fact that it's clear in this story and in all the stories I've read about this particular rebellion in Louisiana and others, is just the enslaved people like knew the news of these locations and passed it around to each other and were informed and making informed decisions based on current events, like world events, right? And so I don't think that's how I learned the history of slavery in America in Tennessee when I was growing up. So it's very important to me to have stories that recapture that or give that bit of agency to those folks and those just like show these are like informed individuals, yes, just you and me, who know about what happened not too far, you know, away from us, our shores, and who are thinking about our place in the world.
You know, people often know more than certain people give them credit for. I remember reporters used to say, my God, I come out to the Iowa caucuses, and I think they're all going to be like Bartles and James, but they're actually like McNeil and Lair.
No, right.
They know things.
Right.
give them some credit.
That's right. Absolutely right. And I think a lot, you know, and that's interesting you said it about the Iowa caucuses and we're in election year and all that. I do think what's great about the Oxford American is that we're interested in folks in the middle of the country and giving that like agency to every single like nook and cranny and quirky cultural group that, you know, their language is, or the language is, you know, only a couple of grandmothers, you know, still speak it comfortably, sure, amongst themselves. Like, we're interested in every single nook and cranny. We don't want to take away remove the complexity or flatten the complexity of this region or the country. And we want to give voice to every single, you know, kind of individual group. And we want to take for granted that they've got something to say, right? Like, fair even enough, in a small, yeah, town, whatever, yeah, small town mom or ladies who lunch or whatever. Like,
no, I was born in a small town. I understand.
Right.
So let's move to a big town, though, GC, because this happens to be where Shirley Horn is from. And I got the ballad collections out, I kind of thought I was going to do Roberta Flack, but I didn't know as much about Shirley Horn until I read this essay. And I was so captivated by the opening where they describe her tempo as so languorous that the white spaces between the notes constituted canvases of their own. And that she sang behind, yeah, the beat so far, it was like a champagne flute caught before it shatters on a granite floor. I mean, I have rarely read an essay where four paragraphs in, I'm like, I cannot wait for the rest of it.
Right.
Really fun and interesting reading.
Right. Lauren DeGraff is just a beautiful writer and scholar, and just has a great ear, I think, for listening to the music that she's writing about. And then is really talented and adept at bringing the reader along with her on this like listening journey, and, you know, situating it in time, but also situating it in like time and context and history and all that, but also grounding it in just like the pure pleasure of hearing this music. Like it, I feel like this is an essay that makes you want to go through these songs.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Oh, absolutely. But I also love the fact that she was a homebody. So much fun. She took a pressure cooker with her on the road.
Right.
That's truly something.
Right. She's cooking greens in her hotel room. I mean, and watching The Bold and the Beautiful all day, and the stories on CBS that my auntie watched, and she can't be bothered when Miles Davis calls to record because dinner's on the table, right? So,
yeah.
It really brings the artist to life, which is another, yes, big goal of mine. Like, as a human being, in addition to being this great artist that changed our lives.
Yeah, no, absolutely agree. So another one, this is from the Point South section. It's from the fall 2022 issue, The Mustang. And I like the piece all the way through, but, you know, some essays really hit it like a perfect no splash dive at the Olympics. And
yeah,
some are really good, but not quite. And this one, the moment I got to the last paragraph, I went, oh, it all is coming together. Mm-hmm. That's when she discloses this is about the last time they got there and Daddy left home soon thereafter.
Yeah.
Of course, the whole thing opens with a clown who says to the father while they're in the car, are you happy?
Right.
What's the significance of that question as we come to understand?
Right. I mean, I think the significance of that question is that there's a journey that happens. I mean, there's a literal journey, right?
Yep.
Where the family is on a road trip to see the grandparents. but also the father or this character that is being perceived is probably not happy in this moment. But in the end, like, spoiler alert, I think he does reach some sort of happiness. At least that's the implication.
I think that is the implication, yes.
Yeah. So I think that question is like just kind of like a launching point for this like personal transformation that happens. And it's so subtle and depth.
It is subtle because, for instance, one detail, she notices that the narrator notices that the parents' thighs are not touching the front seat where the three daughters in the back seat have no choice because the thighs of the car. And that significance that they're not touching later comes back.
Right. Yeah. It does. I mean, this is another masterful writer, Gwen Tompkins, who worked for many years at NPR, also a masterful broadcast journalist. But this is another just, you know, a supremely virtuosic writer that I've gotten the privilege to work with. I think what I love most about this piece is that all that transformation and adult business is taking place purely through the perspective of the narrator as a little girl, and it feels true to the little girl's experience and voice. Even the small, tiny, minute detail she's noticing about her parents' interactions and about her sisters, like, you are do tend to like watch your parents like pretty closely and obsessively, and you do notice like when they're having a worse day than, you know, others. So I really think that she renders this all tenderly, but also just so true to a little girl's voice.
Yeah, it reminded me a bit of a wonderful essay called Accommodations by the short story writer Ford, where he's staying with, I think it's grandparents or an uncle and aunt. They run a hotel, a prime hotel in Little Rock. And there you have as a little kid who sees into how adults, I think he says at one point, how they treat each other when they don't realize others are looking on, especially young people.
Right.
Yeah.
This is another one that's like, you know, you can't really take it for granted how much people understand, even kids, right? Like,
yeah,
kids, they have our number.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think I'm sometimes smarter at age 6, relatively speaking, than at any other point in my life.
That's right.
Yeah.
Same.
Very, very alert to what was going on around me. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, one more I wanted to get to. Back to music, Coming Up Fancy.
Okay.
Found this really intriguing. I had a question based on the nature of the song, and of course it gets into Reba McEntire and so forth, but just the song itself in terms of the costuming and the performance and what kind of vistas it opens up and how the song has kind of gained weight in a nice way over time, if you could speak to those things.
Sure. I think this is, again, just kudos and immense just like appreciation to the writer. Julie Height has written, studied country music and just American music and written about American music for so long and was able to so plainly see all these connections, like kind of the long life of this song over many years and many artists' interpretations. And like all of that was fully like fleshed out as an idea in her mind and as a series of questions that she wanted to ask and also bring together. So the way that she brings them together and brings these connections and ideas to life is through the characters. And she allows, you know, very beautifully, she allows the characters to speak to this added weight. I think the significance of it is just that, you know, we're a magazine and an organization that is interested in the art for sure, but the art not in a two-dimensional sense, the art as it relates to the lives and souls and, you know, happiness and like freedom of our people. So this piece speaks to it so wonderfully. Like, what is it's about, you know, this beautiful and like fun, very fun and uplifting song that also is made whole and made, you know, everything that it can be and more. It reaches its potential through how the audience interacts with it. This to me is about just how important and how central the audience is to any kind of art making. This is, to me, what this story is about.
Yeah, I think that's true, and the connections that are made, because they're not necessarily always sufficiently found at home. Because I thought one of the most important lines was, but what if home isn't a place of sustenance and stability? Because for a lot of people, it just isn't. And that home isn't just literally the house, it's the family one's in, it might be the community, even the region at times, given the dominating, politics and so forth.
Right. Right. Or it could just be a feeling of not being out of place. And the idea that this song is an example of the kind of hope that, again, some kind of transformation can take place and you can shape yourself into a kind of life where you do feel more at home over time. So just like what I also loved about this essay is what it says about McIntyre and her willingness to an interest in letting the song live the way that it wants to live through all these different lives and interpretations, and her like willingness to bring those interpretations in and to give it that extra weight.
I'd seen a documentary about her not long ago, and it really already gotten a very strong appreciation, and this just reinforced that. It to me was interesting because, as you say, it's a magazine about place, and this is an essay about being out of place.
Eternally
exiled in some ways.
Right. I love a lot of stories about placelessness. I think that's just says as much about place and it being like an impermanent state. Just even our particular, the space that we're in right now is going to change. It will never be exactly like this again. So I like stories that can highlight on that impermanence, which is very hopeful. Ultimately, it implies that you can change something that you don't like or that isn't working. So.
Yeah, you don't have to take a passive role. So I was curious, I just happened to notice almost now that the four writers I chose are all women. Mm-hmm. How much would you say that women are driving the essay genre these days?
Oh, that's an awesome question. Yeah, let me think about that. You know, there are some really wonderful men essay writers. I'm thinking right now about Ed Pavlik, whose essay opens the music edition with Roberta Flack on the cover, the Ballads issue. That's the one that has the Shirley Horn article.
Yep.
That essay was just selected for Best American Essays, the volume that's coming out probably in October. And it's intimate and self-reflective in a way that often I wish that everyone could do, right? And I think there's some kind of like assumption that women writers are more likely to be self-reflective and be able to see connections. And I don't think any of that essentialist ideology is the case. But I do think, I think it's rare overall. So maybe women are driving this right now. I'm not sure. There are men who are doing it wonderfully.
Sure. Not meaning to exclude, but I am struck by there are a lot of good, strong, vibrant voices.
Yeah, that's who caught your eye.
And a lot of them are female.
Yeah, that's who caught your eye in this case. I will also say that that's not deliberate, on our part. I'm interested in like a broad range of people, and I don't really care really we don't really care too much about anybody's gender expression or ethnicity.
I was approaching it probably much more as almost a corrective, as it were, because I can think back to like the New Journalism movement that probably helped get the essay form revitalized in the 60s
right.
and 70s, and
right.
the anthology in question I think had 23 writers, of which two, including Joan Didion, appeared.
Right. So I will say that I'm not picking and, curating the magazine to overtly be any kind of corrective.
I totally understand that. And I wasn't smiling much. Yeah.
But I'll say, I don't want to put out an issue that just has all men, right? Unless it's like a theme that we're deliberately, you know, working on. That's like about, sure. I have done a series, a section of an issue about masculinity before, and it was like just men in that section, right? That's very deliberate. But yeah, it's not overtly about correcting anything. But I also want to be aware that we're achieving some sort of balance, you know, when we get closer to the final stages of putting out the edition.
Sure. I really only noticed it because even in this conversation, I was looking just through my notes before we wrapped up and said, yeah, I haven't even chosen four essays, but women, all which I, you know, I chose them because I liked them. They did something for me.
Right. And I think that's how we're choosing also as editors, just like we're choosing things that we like and things that we know the audience will like and enjoy and things that speak to what's happening in our world, in our region. And whoever's doing that, that's who we want to publish.
Fair enough. So I want to thank you again, Danielle, for being my guest. This is Great New American Essays. We've been highlighting the literary magazine Oxford American. I've had the privilege of being joined by its editor, Danielle Amir Jackson. Thank you so much, Danielle.
Thank you so much. It was lovely.